This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and welcome to the History of Singapore. Episode 3, The 99%. In January 1819, Singapore had around 1,000 people, mostly Orang Laut and Bugis, with around 20 to 30 Malays in the Temenggong's entourage and 20 to 30 Chinese. After the establishment of Singapore in February 1819, the Bugis brought over their extensive trading networks to Singapore, allowing it to quickly become the principal port for global and regional entrepôt trade in Southeast Asia. To the port of Singapore came a wide variety of peoples drawn to the opportunity of Singapore like moths to a flame. A port city offered a wide variety of opportunities. Merchants, guards, soldiers, traders, sailors, dock workers, rickshaw pullers, hawkers, entertainers, sex workers. If it could be bought or sold, Singapore was the place to buy or sell it. Not for nothing did Singapore earn the name Singalore. Singapore was in many ways the archetypal pirate port and frontier town, where life was cheap, but anything was possible. They joined people engaged in the more traditional occupations of fishing, jungle products like fruit and wood, and of course, the primary lifeblood of Singapore in the decades before the British arrived, piracy. Because, really, in this period, trade and piracy are two sides of the same coin. They are the same fleets, the same people. Really, the only difference is your circumstances. Times are good, trade. Times are bad, piracy. But when you think about it, colonialism and piracy are also two sides of the same coin. The only difference between the East India Company and the pirates is really that one used the idea of rule of law to justify what they did, something that modern governments everywhere have also learned how to do. But fundamentally, they do the same thing. They take away a port or a ship from the current owners for themselves to make themselves rich. So, in the third Pirates of the Caribbean movie, Chow Yun-fat said, "Welcome to Singapore." Actually, those movies are more accurate than we give them credit for. Not the part of the Kraken or the parts of the ghosts. But, for example, in the first movie, when Jack Sparrow cuts open Elizabeth Swan's corset to save her from choking, and the guard says, "Never would have thought of that." And Captain Sparrow replies, "Clearly you've never been to Singapore." Actually, he was only off by about 100 years. The Pirates of the Caribbean movies are set in the early to mid-1700s, which we know because of the presence of George II, who reigned 1727 to 1760. But 100 years later, people in Singapore would have been happily engaged in all the corset-ripping debauchery that we associate with pirate towns from the heyday of piracy. We were the Port Royal of the East Indies. Actually, the depiction of Port Royal in the movie is closer to what Singapore was like in real life 100 years later than the depiction of Singapore in the movie. And in the movie, the East India Company sought to impose order on the region to allow for trade, their trade, and to crush the freedom-loving pirates. In the movie, the agents of the EIC were Lord Wetherby Swan and Commodore Norrington. In real life, their agents were Sir Stamford Raffles and Major William Farquhar. In the movie, the pirates are Jack Sparrow, Hector Barbosa, and Chow Yun-fat. In real life, the freedom-loving pirates lost and their names are lost to history. And so, over the first 50 years of British rule, piracy was slowly stamped out. Instead, it was three products in particular which made Singapore rich: alcohol, drugs, and slaves. The tax on arak, an alcoholic drink made from either the fermented sap of coconut flowers, sugarcane, grain like red rice or fruit, provided the main revenues for government and administration in Singapore. The opium that the British exported to China and the indentured coolie labor that was imported to Malaya were both shipped through Singapore, and this trade was Singapore's lifeblood. Apart from providing cheap labor for the port and for primary production, the coolie trade itself was also highly profitable and was protected and monopolized by Singapore. In 1853-54, for example, over 13,000 Chinese arrived. By the mid-1870s, over 30,000 Chinese were arriving every month. Many of these were kept locked up on ships and then re-exported to places where labor was needed, like Sumatra. And it went the other direction as well. Many people from other parts of the East Indies were brought to Singapore and then shipped out to be indentured labor everywhere else in the world. So really, when you think about it, Singapore is not that different today. Now, the Chinese were from a wide variety of linguistic and ethnic groups, including the Hokkien, Teochew, Cantonese, Hakka, and Hainanese, but also including groups not considered Han Chinese, such as the Zhuang or Miao. Their arrival changed the complexion of the local Chinese community. The small number of locally born English and Malay-speaking Straits Chinese were supplanted by dialect-speaking Chinese, and the Chinese numbers expanded rapidly, doubling from 6,555 in 1830 to 13,749 in just 6 years. By the middle of the century, they were an absolute majority on the island, and by the early 1900s, they were three-quarters of the population, where their numbers remain today. Immigrants from the rest of the Malay-speaking world also poured in, quickly overwhelming the indigenous community. Immigrants from Sumatra, Malacca, the Riau Archipelago, Java, Boyan, and the other places in the East Indies dominated the Malay community of around 25,000. This is in 1867. The Orang Laut disappeared as a separate community, with many Orang Kalang dying off in a smallpox epidemic. The Bugis traders, without whom Singapore would never have succeeded, whose trade and networks were the main reason for Singapore's initial success, were ruthlessly exploited by British and Chinese businessmen, using British laws that discriminated against the Bugis, backed up by British guns pointed at the Bugis. Remember what I said about colonialism and piracy? This is why the Bugis are perhaps the only community that gets smaller over time, to the point where by the time Singapore becomes a crown colony in 1867, they are actually marginal to Singapore's economy, which has been seized thoroughly by Chinese compradors and the British merchants. Indians were the third largest community, some 10,000 by 1867, mostly merchants, moneylenders and traders, but also soldiers, camp followers and convicts. Most were South Indian, but there were also Sikhs, Punjabis, Gujaratis, Bengalis and Parsis. And there was also a very rich but tiny Arab, Armenian and Jewish communities. So, as I mentioned last week, from 1826 to 67, Singapore was governed by the EIC from Kolkata as part of the Straits Settlements, and the goal of local administration was to maintain free trade as cheaply as possible. Formal state institutions simply did not exist. The mass of the population was left to regulate its own affairs under their own leaders. Officials did not become acquainted with local languages and custom, with few speaking Malay and none speaking Chinese. Actually, official documents and laws had to be sent to Hong Kong for translation. The Singapore Free Press commented in 1857 that, and I quote, "There is probably no other government in the world so incapable of addressing its people as that of the Straits government," unquote. The relatively tiny English-speaking elite were an extremely mixed group, comprising not just Europeans and Chinese, but Malays, Indians, Arabs, Jews, and many other races. In pursuit of commercial success, the merchant elite cultivated British officials, adopted British social habits, spoke English, and allied themselves with the ruling class, acting as intermediaries between the British and the non-English-speaking members of their community. They were generally loyal to the British, even throughout the Indian Mutiny in 1857, or when Britain went to war against China in the 1850s, or throughout Britain's growing hegemony over the Malayan Peninsula. They knew how to use the British rules, the British laws, the British system to their own advantage and benefited from it. And this established a social pattern that persists to this day, reflecting both the emergence of a conservative English-speaking political and professional class from which the post-independence PAP government would draw its leadership. These are the one percenters. But what about the 99%, the rest of the population? What about the rest of us? For it is not from the elite class that local Malayan nationalism would emerge as a force in Singapore. Instead, indigenous nationalism would be driven by the politics of the oppressed, of the workers, of the minorities, of those excluded from wealth and power, those exploited by wealth and power, and indeed, those on whom Singapore's success was built. And it is from the circumstances of British rule, or more specifically the lack of British rule in Singapore, that would allow locally oriented politics to emerge. So imagine then, you have a large community who are left to govern themselves. Who decides who gets to be in charge? What factors within the community decide the leadership? Stay tuned, we'll talk about this after the break. Welcome back. So, where did locally oriented Singaporean politics come from? As mentioned, throughout the 19th century, each community was largely self-regulated, with the British chiefly focused on running the port and providing as much security as they could afford, i.e., not much at all. Crime was rife. But who do you turn to keep the peace? Social services were non-existent. Who do you turn to when you need help? When disputes arise, who arbitrates, who mediates, who keeps the peace? The majority of the Malay community were immigrants largely from the East Indies, Indonesia, divided by language, place of origin, profession, and in this period did not achieve the critical mass to necessitate larger structures of leadership. Meanwhile, the indigenous Malay community lacked leadership for many years because Sultan Hussein lacked the ability to profit from this new change in fortune. His family's fortunes would decline and they sank into poverty. Meanwhile, Temenggong Abdul Rahman died in 1825 and the office remained empty for many years. Leadership of the community devolved to leaders of scattered individual communities. But in 1841, Dayeng Ibrahim, Abdul Rahman's son, was formally installed as Temenggong and he would rise to the challenge. He learned how to play using British rules. He understood how to use the British law and he had home ground advantage and so he prospered. He turned his followers away from traditional pursuits like piracy towards modern pursuits, modern piracy like banking and trade and commerce, and quickly became very wealthy. European merchants courted him for his favour. By 1855, he was able to convince the British to take sovereignty of Johor away from the Sultan and recognise him instead. And his successor, Abu Bakar, established an excellent working relationship with the British. In 1885, they deposed Sultan Ali and recognised Abu Bakar as the Sultan of Johor. Abu Bakar transferred his headquarters to Tanjung Puteri, which we today call Johor Bahru. And while the Johor royal family maintained residences in Singapore and were active in the town's social and sporting life, they played no political role in Singapore. Thus, the small indigenous Malay community's political interests were oriented towards the mainland, across the causeway, and it was not till the 1920s that Singapore's Malay community would formulate an alternative leadership to the traditional aristocracy. The Indian community likewise had little political impact in this period, and unlike China, which officially banned emigration until 1893, India was nearer and had extensive communication and transport links within the British Empire. There was no problem going back and forth to India, and hence less of a focus on the local situation in Singapore. Nor were Indians necessarily interested in working with one another. They were divided by background, language, religion and caste. In the mid-19th century, there were, for example, 17 Parsi, Tamil and North Indian businessmen of high standing in Singapore. but none had any distinction as community leaders. Indeed, the Parsis did not even regard themselves as Indian. After all, the name Parsi in Persian means, quite literally, Persian. So it's no coincidence that it's in the largest community, the Chinese, where locally oriented politics first developed. Lacking traditional leaders, largely cut off from their homeland and reaching a large size, meant that they needed more formal government and structures than the other smaller communities. They shared a common written script and brought with them forms of political and social organization from China, which they adapted to local circumstance. In the early years, the Chinese community was largely regulated by secret societies. The secret societies handled coolie trade and prostitution. Despite their violence and criminality, the key thing, their key ability, was that they could maintain social control within the Chinese-speaking community, and the British considered this the most important thing. They also, of course, provided important social functions. They protected and supported their members. They provided a sort of social safety net, healthcare, housing. But what happened within the community stayed within the community as long as it did not impact British interests. So under official sanction, the secret societies grew rapidly. By 1881, nearly half of the male Singapore Chinese population, 33,103 people out of 72,571, were secret society members. The leading members of the Chinese community, men such as Hu Ake, better known as Wampo, were almost certainly secret society chiefs. Throughout this period, an uneasy tension exists between the secret societies and the colonial authorities. The tiny government needed the secret societies to manage the huge Chinese community. But clashes between secret societies were bad for business. These clashes eventually necessitated the expansion of the colonial police force. Economic causes actually underpin many of these clashes, starting with the first major clash in 1851, which occurred chiefly because the Gambier and pepper prices were at an all-time low. The 1854 rice riot, was rooted in the Chinese community's refusal to offer economic aid to Hokkien refugees. And in response to this riot, the colonial authorities established the Singapore Volunteer Rifle Corps. The post office riots of 1876 were the first notable anti-government protests over the government's attempt to impose a new system of post and financial remittance to China. In 1887, the government tried to move hawkers off the streets, and the entire commercial community went on strike. Mass unemployment, particularly from the exhaustion of the Gambier and pepper plantations in Singapore, had combined with the continued mass immigration to lead to many to turn to hawking to survive. And this is chiefly food, but could be any sort of sales from a temporary stall or cart or even just a pile of goods on the ground. The colonial authorities, however, saw hawkers as unhygienic and preventing the orderly flow of traffic. And this illustrates the typical difference between the tiny colonial government and the mass working class. What one saw as a nuisance, the other saw as freedom to trade and a necessity to survive. We have to work, we want to work, we want to survive, let us work. But of course, the government did not represent the non-British, non-elite community. It represented the British, the merchants, the elites. And the hawkers were getting in their way. And so here we see already the conflict which would eventually drive Singapore's decolonization campaign 100 years later. Who does the government of Singapore serve? All of the people or the elites? The colonial government blamed secret societies for the increasing violence, and especially that they functioned outside the purview of the government. But equally importantly is that the colonial office in London began to prod the local government to take action to stem labour abuses. A commission appointed by Governor Javoir reported in 1876 that, and I quote, "The government knows little or nothing of the Chinese, who are the industrial backbone of these settlements. and the immense majority of them know still little less of the government. Unquote. So as a result, the Chinese Protectorate was established in 1877 to regulate Chinese immigration. Because of the interlinked nature of these issues, its scope was gradually expanded to prostitution, to work, to welfare, and in the end, to general supervision of the entire Chinese community. The Society's Ordinance of 1890 suppressed the secret societies, or broke them up into smaller, more manageable groups, and drove them underground. Thus, from early in the existence of Singapore, the growth of independent political power and resistance to colonial control was met with legislation backed by state-sanctioned violence to destroy the basis of independent political organization on the basis of fundamental difference in values and outlook. So the Chinese community, in response to this, your leadership is gone, what happens? Well, they evolved, and the gap, the leadership gap, was filled by new voluntary, mutually beneficial associations, which were centered around the basic relationships that defined immigrant society: language, family ties, place of origin, and occupation. As a result, Singapore's professions and professional associations were defined by the same relationships as Chinese society at large. It was a natural extension for the associations to embrace economic and professional functions in addition to social and religious functions. So these included mediating disputes, regulating professional recruitment, wages and other terms of employment, and providing benefits such as accommodation to the unemployed and funerals. The relationship between employers and employees was thus not in our modern sense of class terms or relationship to capital, but as an extension of ties of these language and family and origin and occupational ties. In 1867, when Singapore became a crown colony, the structure of the Westminster-style parliament government was instituted. So you have a chief executive, the appointed governor, who consulted his cabinet, called an executive council, and who enacted laws through a legislative body called the Legislative Council. However, at this time, the Legislative Council was merely advisory. Local community leaders were appointed to the Legislative Council as unofficial members, as intermediaries for their community's affairs. This created a petitionary style of representation of the interests of local residents. The status and power of Chinese elites grew as they held pretty much a monopoly of access to the government. After all, it's who you know. In 1889, the status of the local Chinese hierarchy was confirmed with the creation of a Chinese advisory board as the official channel of communication with the Chinese community. Unofficial membership of the Legislative Council, that is, not British officials, hence unofficial, would grow over time. But the governor's final authority remains unchanged until 1942. So here, this system stays intact until the Japanese come along and sweep it all away. Within the Chinese community, lacking a traditional elite, social standing in the community was determined by economic success. If you were richer, you were more powerful and more influential. Merchants thus took the leading role in community affairs. These merchants would often serve in different leadership posts in several different professional, clan, dialect group, and locality associations. In turn, the colonial government made appointments to the Legislative Council, right, to the unofficial seats that I mentioned, and the Chinese Advisory Bureau on the basis of proportional representation of the Chinese community's own dialect group associations. The 1890 Society's Ordinance also implicitly granted official recognition to the structure of Chinese society by registering the associations as benevolent societies. The massive growth of the Chinese community, of their associations, and the access to power that their leadership held introduced a new type of competitive politics in the local Chinese community. So competition for prestige and influence would often lead to an aspiring leader with sufficient resources and support to form a splinter association on the basis of locality or dialect group. For example, say you have the Singapore Pawnbrokers Association. then the Hakka members are not happy because they feel that their interests are not taken care of. So they split off to form the Singapore Hakka Pawnbrokers Association, and so on and so forth. So you saw parties splitting up in Singapore and forming new parties is nothing new. Very long tradition in Singapore. Alternatively, a group of people could, you know, to distinguish themselves, form a new association to separate themselves from a larger association that they shared with people that they felt they had fewer common interests with, or simply that they perceived to be, you know, inferior social and economic standing. Membership of these associations was not exclusive. Many people belonged to many different organizations that overlapped, although people naturally did not join rival organizations. But the ease of creating new associations and the personal ambitions of leaders translated to a wealth of associations. So, for example, by the early 1900s, there are only 96 surnames, Chinese surnames in Singapore, but over 200 different clan associations. That is how fierce the politics within the Chinese community were. This diversity of associations also recognized a united voice as necessary to maximize influence. And this was established in 1906, the Singapore Chinese Chamber of Commerce, the pinnacle of Chinese society in Singapore. Its committee included the most prominent leaders of the various Chinese associations, whose membership was carefully proportioned to represent all the different dialect groups in Singapore. The Singapore Chinese Chamber of Commerce's functions grew accordingly to encompass a range of functions in Singapore society. Social welfare, education, halting riots, resolving disputes, all the way to anti-Japanese activities in the late 1930s. It was the spokesman for the Chinese community. It represented its views to the government. Although, of course, these views tended to be the views of its merchant leaders rather than actually the whole community. In turn, the government used the chamber to disseminate its policies and regulations. Businessmen who wanted to influence government regulations would work through the Chinese Chamber of Commerce, which would represent them and negotiate on their behalf. So we thus see the beginnings, right, the formation of indigenous politics in Singapore. And this structure would last from 1867 all the way until 1942, so about 80 years. The Chinese sphere lacked traditional leadership, was cut off from the ancestral homeland, and was large and diverse, and so necessitated formal structures. And within each group, associations were formed both for protection, but also to advance the interests of the group. These groups would compete with each other, they'd seek to gain members and to rise within the ranks of the Chinese political sphere, and the prize, right, the prize was to climb to the top of the Chinese parliament, say, you know, we can call it that. The Singapore Chinese Chamber of Commerce was pretty much the Chinese parliament. Its seats, the voting structure divided up according to proportional representation. And once you reach the top, you get appointed to the Legislative Council as an unofficial member, thus gaining direct access to the ears of the governor. So these 19th century associations would provide a long training in the art of politics and organization and lobbying, and would be the precursors to the 20th century trade unions and associations and political parties that would form the basis for Singapore politics after World War II. So when we think about political parties in Singapore after World War II, we have to remember they are drawing on this long tradition of indigenous politics. And later in this series, we are going to see a lot of how political parties and movements after the war all drew explicitly on this same model pioneered by the Chinese Chamber of Commerce. Throughout this period, Singapore's political sphere would remain largely settled since the British had unquestioned power and grievances were directed towards specific issues rather than the principle of, you know, who rules at large. But in the 20th century, technological and ideological change would soon transform politics in Singapore and usher in the age of nationalism. and Singapore's Hokkien and Teochew and Cantonese and Javanese and Boyanese and Tamils and Sikhs and Jews would become Malayan. So join us next week as we examine this age of nationalism, these new ideas of self-determination and nationalism, and watch them sweep the world and ask, where did they come from? As always, if you have any questions or comments or spot any mistakes, please email thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com, visit my website at thehistoryofsingapore.com, and if you'd like to support the podcast, please visit my Patreon page, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.